Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Center for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCIX, A Diminished Rome. While much of the Roman Empire was lost during the rule of Gallienus, we don't really know how much of that is his fault, or really get a sense of his reign. Was he responsible for the loss of territories, or was he simply just a victim of his time? Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Gallienus and his wife Salonina seem to have spent 4 or 5 years initially in Rome itself, and it's from this period in the city that we get the stories about his luxury and extravagance, the idea that he is living it up while the empire is falling apart. And as I said, I think a lot of these stories come from the senatorial hostility towards him because he did not appoint them to military commands anymore. But it's still interesting to think of Gallienus in the historiographical imagination as to what they thought he was getting up to in Rome. And the story is very much along the lines of Nero and Caligula. So I'll just quote the Historia Augusta, Life of Gallienus 16.2, which says, and I quote, "He built castles of apples, preserved grapes for 3 years, and served melons in the depth of winter. He always served out of season green figs and apples fresh from the trees." So the idea that, you know, all he concerned about is his own food and, you know, having supply of fresh fruit year long round. I continue. "He sprinkled his hair with gold dust. He went out in public adorned with the radiant crown. And at Rome, where the emperors always appeared in the toga, he appeared in a purple cloak with jeweled and golden clasps." You know, I don't think emperors ever went out wearing a radiant crown. I mean, they had them on statues.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's the idea here that, you know, he wants to be venerated, you know, as a triumphant conqueror in a purple cloak, but, you know, putting aside the toga so he's not, you know, appearing like a fellow senator. He's appearing greater than everyone. And there is also a tradition about his effeminacy, and we see this in the Emperor Julian's work on the Caesars, when all the deceased emperors come together and are judged at a Saturnalia banquet, and Gallienus is said to have appeared with the dress and languishing gait of a woman. His self-image is quite different from many other emperors at the time. He has this sort of strongly Hellenistic portraiture. He doesn't really have like the close-cropped soldier's beard. He has like a curly neck beard and often like a little moustache. So there's the sense there that he cultivated a different image from the soldier emperor. Now, there is one source which provides an interesting take on cultural life under Gallienus, and this is Porphyry's Life of the Philosopher Plotinus, who lived in Rome during Gallienus's reign and gained followers amongst the senatorial order. Plotinus is a very interesting figure because originally he joined the campaign of Gordian III against the Persians before escaping with his life and making his way back to the Roman territory.
Yeah, the name sounds familiar.
Yeah, we would have talked about it briefly with Gordian.
Yeah, yes. Okay, all right.
In the Life of Plotinus, Porphyry writes, "The Emperor Gallienus and his wife Salonina greatly honoured and venerated Plotinus. He tried to make full use of their friendship. They were said to have been in Campania, a city of philosophers which had fallen into ruin. This he asked them to revive and to present the surrounding territory to the city when they had founded it. Unfortunately for Plotinus, the plan was spoiled by jealous courtiers who opposed him."
Mm.
But the story, I think, shows that, you know, there is a court in Rome that, you know, cultivates philosophy. In many ways, that life is continuing even while parts of the empire are falling apart.
I think that sort of behaviour would be fine if there weren't exceptional circumstances.
Yes,
in the empire. Like, you could have done this and got away with it and it not have been unusual to have a preoccupation with fruit 100 years earlier. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
And that is a time when soldiers thrive.
Mm. Yeah, I think Gallienus did try and work through his generals. And so Aureliolus, another general like Marcianus, you know, these men he promoted up through the ranks. And in this, he didn't quite read the mood of the times that he should be out on the frontiers himself. Mm. There's that reference, you know, in the reign of Postumus that he's involved in the siege, where he gets wounded by an arrow, but he doesn't seem to have been personally leading from the front. He does visit Greece in 264, where he's inducted into the Eleusinian Mysteries.
So he's got time for that. He's lost two sons to war.
It might be him surveying the new fortifications after the Gothic invasion of Greece, because Eleusis is sacked.
So it's a working holiday.
A working holiday.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
look,
exactly. I can't exactly criticise him for that.
Well, I mean, obviously it's a very problematic period, but the run of usurpation starts after his father is captured, and that's not his fault.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, look, I'm not saying any of this is his fault.
No. No, he's an interesting character. If only we had more sources from what's going into Rome, what the HA says might be completely justified or might be completely wrong.
All of this is fine, but an emperor has obligations.
I think he would misreading the mood of the time, which is, you know, he should be out there at the front all the time, not leading the armies.
Not preserving grapes for 3 years, which is making sultanas.
Yes.
Did they not have a word for sultanas?
I wonder if it's, you know, preserving the grapes intact as grapes. Okay. I don't know how you would do that, but again, I suppose it's be fantastical control over the elements. You know, the sort of thing that only emperors can do if they have too much time and money.
Yes, well, meanwhile, in the empire.
Yes.
Okay, so we've now got more of a view, I think, of Gallienus, despite the fact that these are blatantly hostile sources.
Mm.
It's easy for me to believe that he was distracted.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think there was so much going on that he's in some ways a victim of circumstances, and a brilliant, competent emperor couldn't have done a better job.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, he survived 8 years.
Yeah.
I think that's very impressive.
Mm. So, meanwhile, in the empire,
Goths.
We're now back to the Goths.
Yes. The Goths in Greece.
Okay, so the Goths periodically seem to, you know, that time of the year again, let's sally forth and go south and raid and take slaves and then go back across the river.
That's right.
This is schoolies week for the Goths.
Oh, yes. Particularly violent form of schoolies week, I have to say.
Again, yes. Schoolies week.
Yes. Yes, no, the Goths are not looking for territory. They're not looking to settle. They're looking for booty and captives.
Yeah. You know,
exactly right.
This is what happens this time. So they come south. This is in 262.
Yes, probably 262. The dating is controversial. But we know from new fragments of Dexippus, you know, this is original Dexippus, which were found in the Austrian National Library in Vienna a few years ago, that Goths made their way south into the province of Achaia, Greece, with the intent of stealing offerings from the Greek sanctuaries.
Mm.
And Dexippus writes that the Greeks elected three generals to oversee the defence of their province. This is the provincial governor, Marianus, a Philostratus from Athens, and Dexippus, confusingly, not the same as the historian, but a man from Boeotia. And these three men taking command decided to block the path at Thermopylae. So, of course, this is the famous narrow path which you need to go through. And this is what Dexippus says, and I quote from the new fragment. When the approach of the Scythians, that is the Goths, was reported to the Greeks, they gathered at Thermopylae and set about the task of blocking them from the narrow passes there. Some carried small spears, others axes, others wooden pikes overlaid with bronze and with iron tips, whatever each man could arm himself with. And when they came together, they completely fortified the perimeter wall and devoted themselves to its protection with haste. And it seemed that the area was otherwise very secure, since the road which led to Greece beyond the gates was narrow and impractical on account of the harsh terrain. So this is really interesting. Achaia doesn't have its legions. It has some auxiliaries.
Yeah.
But here it's clear that it's very much local defence. So spears, axes, pikes with bronze, whatever each man could have in order to create a perimeter to block the Goths.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be an effective defense.
No.
And it's concerning that this is what Greece has.
Yes. And the fact that this has happened before, for example, under Decius as well.
Yeah.
Now, we know the Greeks were successful in the battle, but they still made their way through the land of the Achaeans. So they still got through.
Yeah.
It's not straightforward. So historian Augusta Gallienus says they did retreat through the lands of the Achaeans after their defeat. So there must have been some kind of important victory there, or at least, you know, a stalemate. But, you know, they did despoil Eleusis and Athens, etc.
Okay.
Dexippus, in his account, gives the governor Marianus a pre-battle speech in which he rouses the troops. And I quote, "O Greeks, the occasion of our preservation for which you are assembled and the land in which you have been deployed are both truly fitting to evoke the memory of virtuous deeds. For your ancestors, fighting in this place in former times, did not let Greece down and deprive it of its free state. For they fought bravely in the Persian wars and in the conflict called the Lamian War, and when they put to fight Antiochus, the despot from Asia, at which time they were already working in partnership with the Romans who were then in command." So the message of this speech, as we see throughout much of Dexippus's work, is that the Greeks should, you know, they stand this proud tradition of their forefathers at Thermopylae and other places, you know, stood their ground as well as they could. But then also, you know, they're working on behalf of their Roman overlords, and they're working with them, a partnership here to try and defeat the invading forces.
Mm. Should it be a partnership?
Well, really, no. Well, this is the thing. So the Romans control their territory.
This is Rome.
Yes, yes. However, there is a strong sense of still of Greek pride and Greek independence.
Yeah.
And there are many free cities, free Greek cities, both in Greece and Asia Minor, that are, you know, free from taxation. Aphrodisias is one, for example, and that they see themselves as partners of the Romans, as brothers. This is really interesting. It gives us an insight into the Greek mindset at the time.
Okay, so they're successful at that point in seeing off the Goths.
Yes, though the Goths do plenty of raiding. This may explain Gallienus's visit to Athens in September-October of 264, trying to strengthen the defences of Attica.
We have another Gothic invasion, though, a few years later. This is 267.
Yes, a group of Herulean Goths sail down from the Black Sea to Byzantium. They are fought off by two of Gallienus's generals, Athenaeus and Cleodamus. Others head down by boat to Greece. They sack the islands of Lemnos and Scyros, and then, we are told, sack and burn Athens, Corinth, Sparta, and Argos. We know that the attack on Athens is devastating, certainly by the destruction layers we see in the archaeological record. And the remains of many buildings that are destroyed are later reused to build a wall around Athens called the Post-Herulean Wall. So that's full of spolia, so column fragments, inscriptions that come from buildings that were destroyed in this sack. Now, we know, however, that 2,000 Athenians managed to escape the city, and they try and mount resistance against the Goths. And in this case, the resistance is organised by Dexippus, the historian, who retells these events in his Scythica. He and the other Athenians, which we're told about 2,000, find themselves on the mountains around the outside looking at their ruined city. And Dexippus delivers a speech when he tries to rally them to fight back against the Goths as they leave. It features similar themes to the speech of Marianus in the earlier fragment. So I quote, "I am told that the emperor's fleet is nearly here to bring us help. Once we have joined forces, our attack will be invincible. Furthermore, I am confident that we shall inspire the rest of Greece to the same level of courage. As for me, I am happy to face danger and peril, since I yearn for honour and to stand in harm's way, desiring to accomplish the most notable deeds so that the city's worth may not be diminished through any deed of mine." So we know that Dexippus and his ragtag group of men do actually lead a successful skirmish against the Herulean Goths as they leave.
So can I sidebar there and go, how likely is it that Dexippus himself, the historian, actually did this? because, you know, he could go, the Greeks won there, and that's thanks to me, because I'm the one writing the account here.
Yes. I mean, there are some historians who don't believe it. They think the speech actually wasn't delivered by Dexippus, or Dexippus isn't, you know, the person who's leading the account. So I mean, there are some skeptics out there.
This is literally history being written by the victors. Yeah, yes, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, it's also the problem is the text is fragmentary. So in the Byzantine period, the Emperor Constantine Porphyrogenitus commissioned historians and scribes to excerpt great speeches from previous works.
Yeah.
So we don't actually have the full context. We just have the speech.
Again, this is a local resistance, though.
That is right.
What's the Roman contribution to resistance to the Goths?
The main contribution is by Gallienus's general, Marcus Aurelius Marcianus. Now, Gallienus himself may have come to the Balkans during this period. We don't quite know.
Yeah.
But certainly Marcus Aurelius Marcianus is a dux. He is a protector. There are statues erected in his honour in Thrace and in other regions of the Greek East for his role in pursuing and defeating the Herulean Goths. There are later stories that a treaty was reached with the leader and that he was granted consular ornaments by Gallienus, but this is from Sincellus, who's a very, very late Byzantine author. So really, it's Gallienus's generals again doing the work.
Okay. So we said a couple of episodes that Gallienus's downfall was connected to a revolt staged by his general Aureolus.
Mm.
So can we now rejoin that story?
Yes. So he is brought down by the men that he has supported and fostered over the previous 8 years. So Aureolus revolts in northern Italy and tries to side with Postumus, even minting coins in favor of Postumus. Gallienus and his troops engage him at battle at a place now called Pons Aureolus, the bridge of Aureolus. And Gallienus lays siege to him in Milan. However, the generals who are amongst Gallienus's innermost coterie become disenchanted with his rule. And in fact, you know, this disenchantment has likely been going on for some time already.
Mm.
These include the Praetorian prefect Aurelius Heraclianus, Marcus Aurelius Claudius, who's probably in charge of the cavalry, or is a tribune. It's difficult to know that the military titles are not exact in the literary sources. And Lucius Domitius Aurelianus, who is a military officer of uncertain rank. And it's interesting that amongst these cabal are two future emperors, Aurelian and Claudius II.
Mm.
Now, there are different stories about the plot and how it was enacted. According to Zosimus, Book 1, Chapter 40, they enlisted a commander of Dalmatian horsemen called Cecropius to oversee the plan. According to Zosimus, the conspirators stood by Gallienus at supper and informed him that some of the spies had brought intelligence that Aureolus and his army were close at hand. By this, they considerably alarmed him. Calling immediately for his horse and arms, he mounted, ordering his men to follow him in their armour, and rode away without any attendants. Thus, the captain, Cecropius, finding him alone, killed him. Now, personally, I think it's highly unlikely that Gallienus, with no one around him, would suddenly ride into battle to be killed by someone without anyone else seeing him.
It feels a bit more proactive than we've talked about Gallienus in this episode.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Other stories are even more implausible. So Aurelius Victor in chapter 33 in his work on the Caesars claims that Aureliolus put together a kill list, or a list of people who were traitors and should be offed, signed by Gallienus, and threw it over the wall for the conspirators to find. However, this is a very common trope. We see this also uses explanations for the murder of Domitian and also the murder of Aurelian as well.
Oh, that's right. The fake lists. Yeah,
the fake list. The fake list appears again and again.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think either of those stories are very plausible, but there clearly is a conspiracy from inside. And some of the stories then try to exonerate Claudius because he becomes emperor later. And he is also later claimed as the ancestor of the House of Constantine.
Okay. So we want him to appear blameless.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's one story where Claudius is chosen by Gallienus as he lay dying. So this is in Aurelius Victor, that, you know, he sends a messenger to Ticinum, where Claudius is a tribune, and said, you know, I anoint you as my successor.
Yeah.
And that way, you know, the whole house of Constantine is legitimated, and Claudius II goes on to be a great general. That is virtually certainly wrong. What we do know is there is a purge. Salonina is killed. Gallienus's brother, Licinius Valerianus, is killed. Also, Marinianus, who's probably his last and youngest son. Aurelius Victor writes, the Senate in Rome hated him so much that they had his followers and friends thrown down the Gemonian steps. You know, this is where your traitors were killed. There's this purge. We're ending that dynasty. And control is now in the hands of these military men, most who come from the Balkans, whom Gallienus has fostered over the past, you know, 8 years or so.
Okay.
He failed to make that crucial connection that, you know, people who are not senators could, you know, be just as good as emperors, and in fact might actually have the support of the army.
I mean, how is this not a usurpation?
It is a usurpation. It's a successful usurpation. And Claudius wins, I mean, I'm preempting the next episode, but Claudius wins a good reputation because he doesn't actually rule for very long. And he wins an important victory against the Goths while he's still alive.
Mm.
So, you know, he takes the title Gothicus, and he later becomes the ancestor of the House of Constantine.
Yeah, okay.
So he has a positive reputation.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. So it's not a direct challenge by somebody with a rival army that finally does Gallienus in. It's just his own officers from within.
It comes from within, yes.
And we've seen that countless times.
Exactly. You know, when we think of, you know, Caligula is murdered by, you know, Cassius Chaerea and people who hated him at his court. Domitian is murdered by his court.
Alexander Severus is murdered by his own men.
Elagabalus, you know, it goes on and on and on.
I'm not going to call it, you know, as reliable as the Historia Augusta's account or anything like that, by which I'm saying is not entirely reliable.
Yes.
But we've got to see it through the lens of somebody who, if not was a good emperor, is somebody who's definitely been rehabilitated by later emperors. By that, I mean Claudius II.
Yes, exactly.
So he can't be tainted by having blood on his hands.
Exactly.
By taking the purple this way. Yeah.
And Gallienus is remembered in later sources, in the later Latin panegyrics, you know, which are written in Gaul, the late 3rd or 4th centuries, you know, the man who presided over the disintegration of the Roman Empire.
Mm.
And yes, that is true in some senses. You know, he entrusted the East to Odenathus to control it for him. You know, the Gallic Empire did break away. But, you know, his generals actually did their job very, very well. And, you know, he himself survived for 8 years. So, you know, he certainly wasn't the best emperor that Rome ever produced. But I think, you know, we should give him some credit for some things as well.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any convenient podcasting platform. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast has been produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we have another lesson in Latin. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.